the headlines this hour. Iran's leader slams the UK, France, and Germany for their anti-Tehran stance and, quote, wrongful interference in regional affairs. At least 14 people were killed, many others wounded, following two blasts in the city of Bamiyan in central Afghanistan. And a Turkish court adds six new defendants to the case against Saudi officials charged with the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Hello, welcome to SIS News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has lashed out at Britain, France, and Germany for their stance on Tehran's missile program. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also slammed the European countries for their complicity with the U.S. in putting the Iranian nation under the pressure of sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei described the anti-Iran sanctions as a crime perpetrated by the U.S. and its European allies. Journalist and commentator Mustafa Khoshesh says that Iran needs to improve its economy to confront threats and sanctions imposed by the U.S.
Sanctions are the main weapons tools of the United States and its allies in confronting Iran. After years, they developed a kind of strategy that's called containment to push Tehran to talks to receive concessions from Tehran, and the experience that we had with under the nuclear deal. And posing credible military threat is the second wing. These two wings would help them push Tehran to the talks in order to receive concessions. So what the leader is saying is that Iran needs to work very hard on its economy to repeat the same experience that it had in its military power. This happened all as a result of three decades of hard work on Iran's military power. And now everyone acknowledges that Iran is a military power in this region. And what the Iranian leader is saying is that Iran needs to work on its economy in a similar way to repeat the same and similar experience.
At least 14 people have been killed and dozens others injured in twin blasts in central Afghanistan. The blast hit a market in Bamiyan City, which is the capital of a province with the same name. Police chief said the blast killed 12 civilians and two traffic policemen. No group has yet claimed responsibility. Afghanistan continues to suffer from insecurity nearly 20 years after the U.S. and its allies invaded the country. Correspondent Amin Alami joins us. Tell us more about this. I mean, what exactly has happened, and give us an update about the number of casualties and or injured.
Well, Bamiyan province in central Afghanistan is considered as one of the most secure provinces across the country. But the city of Bamiyan witnessed twin bomb blasts today, and according to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry spokesperson Tariq Aryan, at least 14 individuals, including a police traffic, were killed, and 45 others, all of them civilians, were injured as a result of these magnetic bomb blasts in Bamiyan, the capital city of Bamiyan province in central Afghanistan. According to local officials, the blasts happened in front of a crowded market in the city of Bamiyan. In a separate incident here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, another magnetic bomb blast targeted a police vehicle. The Interior Ministry spokesperson also confirmed this incident here in the capital, Kabul, and says that two individuals, both of them police forces, have been injured as a result of this latest bomb blast in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Let's not forget that the terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban, have recently stepped up their attacks, bombings, and coordinated and complex attacks across Afghanistan, mainly since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks between the Afghan government negotiating team and the Taliban militant group negotiating team in the Qatari capital, Doha. The militants, mainly the Taliban, use different tactics to spread further violence and bloodshed in this country. One of those tactics is planting magnetic bomb blasts and targeting military vehicles, not only military vehicles, but also they have repeatedly targeted other government employees and even media workers. Just about two or 3 weeks ago, Kabul witnessed a very huge Soch bomb blast that claimed the life of a well-known TV host here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Still, the case of that bomb blast is under investigation, according to Afghan security officials. But generally, we can say that insecurity is on the rise in Afghanistan, despite intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, and despite the rise of trips of Afghan officials to mainly regional countries, as well as the trips of officials from regional countries to Afghanistan. I talked to the spokesperson of Iran's foreign ministry, who is currently in Kabul, just a few hours ago. He also said that Iran is after bringing peace and stability and security to Afghanistan. That is why he said that I'm here to discuss about most important issues, mainly regarding to peace and stability here. Mr. Khatibzadeh, who is the spokesperson of Afghanistan, Iran's foreign affairs ministry, also said that Iran backs only a peace process that should be under the leadership of the Afghan government and must respect the achievements of the Afghan people and the Afghan government, as well as any peace talk must respect the Afghan constitution and many other values. So it shows that not only Afghanistan's neighboring countries and regional countries, but also the Afghan government itself is after finding another solutions instead of relying too much on its Western backers, mainly the ongoing Geneva conference on Afghanistan is underway, and the Afghan president and the Afghan government has once again asked the international community to strongly continue to support Afghanistan. But in the meantime, as I mentioned, the rise of trips of Afghanistan's top political officials to neighboring countries and regional countries proves that Afghanistan is following a new policy in order to strengthen its ties with its neighboring countries and regional countries in order to bring peace and stability to this country.
Thank you very much for that. Amin Alami talking to us there from Kabul. Many thanks. Turkish court has added six new defendants to the case against Saudi officials charged with the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The main court in Istanbul held a second hearing in the trial in absentia of 26 Saudi suspects. The court also heard testimony from one of Khashoggi's friends. He revealed that the Saudi journalist was threatened by people close to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. September, Saudi court handed 20-year prison sentences to five people while sentencing another three to 7 to 10 years in jail. The Saudi hit squad killed Khashoggi and dismembered his body at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. The incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that the Saudi crown prince himself ordered the killing of the journalist. Hello, welcome to the News Review. The U.S. federal agency that must sign off on the presidential handover has told projected winner Joe Biden that he can formally begin the transition process. In a letter to Biden, General Services Administration's Chief Emily Murphy said that she will make available resources and services to go ahead with the power transition. President Donald Trump said in a tweet that he has recommended to the GCA head to do what needs to be done, but he insisted that he was still refusing to concede, saying that he will keep up the fight to challenge the election results. The agency has been under pressure to free up millions of dollars in funds, office space, and briefings for Biden's team. The president has so far refused to concede defeat in the November 3rd election, claiming that the vote was rigged in favor of his Democratic rival. Colin Campbell is our correspondent, who joins us from Washington, D.C. And we also have Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University. So, Colin, please tell us what's going on. I mean, it's kind of confusing to find out the state of affairs here.
Yeah, it's been kind of confusing since Election Day, hasn't it, for many people and most Americans. And what's happening here is we've had a president who's been very reluctant to concede the race. He's been challenging the election results in various states throughout the country so that he could stay president of the United States. He says that he won re-election by a lot. There really has not been any evidence to support that. However, he has been trying to find that evidence, or at least trying to find a way that he could still retain his position as the commander-in-chief. Now, what happened with the General Services Administration is that it allowed for the funding that is usually given to transition teams to be allowed. So Emily Murphy, who was a hand-picked person by the president who runs this agency, finally said that she would allow for the funds to go to the transition team so they could have access to federal office space, so they could have access to federal records, and so that they can begin that transition process. Now, she said that she came to it, and in her letter, she says she came to it independently. Some people have questioned the way that she wrote it out, that she came to this decision independently, that she wasn't coerced or forced. Some people believe that because she wrote that, it may be that the opposite is true. However, she did say that she independently came to this decision to now release these funds to the president-elect's office or cabinet, if you will. And what she did do is, right after Michigan had certified the results in favor of the president-elect, this is when she made the decision. So she said that she was practicing due diligence, making sure that most of these cases that fought election results were decided before she made that decision. And so that's where we are now.
All right. Okay. So Lawrence Davidson, I'm not too sure where to go with this. I mean, you have a president that says, okay, maybe, go ahead. What kind of damage is this doing? First of all, we're talking about damage to the democracy, I think, that is practiced in the U.S. And second of all, perhaps the relationship with other countries, because you have, for example, Russia, who is still not acknowledging the fact that Biden is going to be the next president, and the others maybe not 100% footing, sending congratulatory, I guess, messages to Biden and are receiving them. So tell us how those two areas stand.
Well, first of all, let me say that Trump knows that he can't carry this on to a personal victory of his. So he's now planning, essentially, to vacate this office, at least now. So the GSA decision, which he took and told her to do, is a signal that he will vacate the office, okay? And on January 20th, he'll be out of the White House. I have no doubt whatsoever. However, he has established for himself what is called a leadership pack, which essentially allows him to solicit funds from those 70 million people who voted for him, and he will essentially play the fraud game with them for the next 4 years, and essentially tell them that he's going to run for office again in 2024. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. I mean, and he will never concede. He will never say it was fair and I lost fairly. This has done a lot of damage to the United States, particularly domestically, because Trump's egocentric stalling has prevented any real Biden getting in on the ground running to deal with the COVID pandemic. That's the major damage that it's done. In terms of other countries, they'll come along. Most of the European countries have come along. Russia will come along, of course. China will come along. I mean, this is a fait accompli. I mean, this is the next president, And they will recognize that. It's just they want to take their own time. So I think that the problem here that in terms of damage is basically domestic and basically a function of Biden's trying to implement a plan for the pandemic in a smooth and organized way.
Okay, and finally, quickly, Colin, if you can, you know, you still have these 70 million people who voted for Trump. I mean, what are they saying? What are they doing? Are they doing anything? I mean, are they in the social media venting out, or are they gathering and talking about this? What are they up to?
No, not really. I mean, what it seems like is that they are doing it in kind of piecemeal. You have some outspoken members coming from the Republican Party, like Senator Mitt Romney, Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine. But you really don't have a large group of legislators coming out to really condemn the president or to push this process along. I suspect that as Michigan has certified, Pennsylvania is supposed to follow suit. We also have Georgia doing a recount after a recount. I think once these states are all certified, you may start to hear more Republicans coming out and saying, okay, enough is enough. We really need to move on. But right now, a lot of them are really basing their political capital and connecting it to the president. So they've been very quiet. We do know that we have a vengeful president, a vindictive president. So if a legislator were to come out and prematurely, to the president's estimation, and say, hey, let's keep this moving, the president could lash out, and some people believe that that is bad for their political brand. So they've been remaining quiet. Some would call it just straight up cowardly, but that is an assessment that various Americans are making.
Okay, and I do have another question, Lawrence Davidson, if you can answer it quickly. We know that Trump has passed on, though he was contemplating attacking Iran. Do you think that he is still contemplating moves such as that in order to stay in office?
No. I mean, he might. He's a very unpredictable fellow, but he might lash out in one direction or another in terms of foreign policy. At Iran, perhaps, but I don't think it certainly would not keep him in office. And as far as we know, his advisors are all telling him not to do that kind of thing. So I think he's concentrating now on essentially how much money he can get over the next 4 years from that 70 million, because he's very much in debt, and what he should do in terms of avoiding prison in New York State. So I can't tell you for sure he won't lash out at Iran, but I would be very, very surprised if he did anything like that.
Thank you for that, Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University. Colin Campbell, thank you for all the information and updates there. Our correspondent talking to us from Washington, D.C. That does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Rural American healthcare systems entered the coronavirus pandemic in already precarious financial positions. Over the years, shifting demographics, declining revenue, and increasing operating expenses have made it harder for rural hospitals to stay in business. The pandemic has made it even more difficult. In mid-March, most rural hospitals in the United States halted elective procedures to slow down the spread of the virus, cutting their revenue further, and many have faced price gouging for supplies given extreme shortages. Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKenney, who practices family medicine in Fredonia, Kansas, said, "The community is tired, frustrated, and stubborn. Politicians talk about relying on personal responsibility to end the pandemic, but I don't see a majority of people wearing face masks in public spaces, despite pleas from health professionals. Some people are scared. Others act as if COVID-19 doesn't exist." We're prepared for you an article written by Lauren Hughes. The piece is titled, "U.S. Rural Hospitals Are Facing Unprecedented Challenges Amid Worsening Pandemic." The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Lauren Hughes's article. It's difficult to put into words how hard COVID-19 is hitting rural America's hospitals. North Dakota has so many cases, it's allowing asymptomatic COVID-19 positive nurses to continue caring for patients to keep the hospital staffed. Iowa and South Dakota have teetered on the edge of running out of hospital capacity. Yet in many communities in rural America, the initial cooperation and goodwill seen early on in the pandemic have given way to COVID-19 fatigue and to anger, making it hard to implement and enforce public health measures, like wearing face masks that can reduce the spread of the disease. Rural healthcare systems entered the pandemic in already precarious financial positions. Over the years, shifting demographics, declining revenue, and increasing operating expenses have made it harder for rural U.S. hospitals to stay in business. The pandemic has made it even more difficult. In mid-March, most rural hospitals in the United States halted elective procedures to slow the spread of the coronavirus, cutting their revenues further, and many have faced price gouging for supplies given extreme shortages. "We work with rural doctors and hospital administrators across the country as a researcher, and we see the stress they're under from the pandemic." Here is what two of them, Connie Martin, Chief Executive Officer at San Luis Valley Health in Alamosa, Colorado, and Dr. Jennifer Bacani McKenney, who practices family medicine in Fredonia, Kansas, are facing. "Their experiences reflect what others are going through and how rural communities are innovating under extraordinary pressure." Dr. Connie Martin from Alamosa, Colorado, said, "COVID-19 fatigue is real. It's wearing on people. Everyone wishes we were past this. I read the other day about healthcare workers being the keeper of fears. During COVID-19, patients have disproportionately placed their fears on clinicians, many of whom experience the same fears themselves. I focus on building resilience, but it's hard." Dr. Connie Martin noted, "My hospital currently has 7 patients with COVID-19 and can make room for as many as 12. Back in spring, we converted a visiting specialist center into a temporary respiratory clinic to keep potentially infectious patients separate and reduce pressure on our emergency department. It's all about making sure we have enough staff and hospital capacity." Dr. Connie Martin added, "There isn't any hospital that isn't under siege, which means that getting patients to the right level of care can be a challenge. In the past few days, we have accepted 3 transfers from facilities that are on the front range. We've never had to do this before. With 6 intensive care unit beds and 10 ventilators, we are trying to help others. She added, "Influenza hasn't arrived yet in our community, and I worry about when it comes. We have nearly 40 staff out right now on isolation or quarantine, a staggering number for a small health facility. We are having to shift staffing coverage in half-day increments to keep up." She continued, "We are not at a point where we are even contemplating bringing COVID-19 positive staff back to work, like the governor of North Dakota suggested. I hope we never get there. However, we are considering high-risk versus low-risk exposures. If a clinician is exposed to COVID-19 during an aerosolizing medical procedure, that's high risk. If a clinician is exposed to a classroom of 50 people who are all socially distanced and wearing face masks, that's low risk. If we face critical workforce needs, we may bring back healthcare workers that have had low-risk exposures." Dr. Connie Martin added, "We have gained a lot of knowledge this year, and we all feel wiser now, but definitely we feel older too." Dr. Jennifer Bacani-McKinney from Fredonia, Kansas said, "We chose to live in a rural community because we look out for one another. Our one grocery store will deliver to your home. Our sheriff's department will drive medications outside of city limits. If we could return to our rural values of caring for and protecting one another, we would be in a better position. Somewhere along the way, these values took a back seat to politics and fear." Dr. Jennifer Bacani-McKinney said, "Wilson County, where I practice in southeast Kansas, didn't see its first COVID-19 case until 15th of April. By August, you could still count the number of cases on 2 hands. But by mid-November, the total was over 215 cases in a county with a population of about 8,500, meaning about 1 out of every 40 residents had been infected with coronavirus." She added, "Our 25-bed critical access hospital doesn't have dedicated intensive care unit beds, and it has only 2 ventilators. Emergency department calls are split among the 5 physicians in Fredonia. In addition to dealing with COVID-19 cases, we're managing every other illness and injury that walks through the door, including strokes, heart attacks, traumatic injuries, and rattlesnake bites." She added, "We have sectioned off a hallway of rooms for suspected COVID-19 patients. However, without an intensive care unit, we have to rely on other hospitals. Recently, my partner had to transfer a patient who had a gastrointestinal bleed. She had to call 11 different hospitals to find one that could take the patient." She added, "I feel lucky to have on-site testing in the hospital laboratory, but like many of my rural peers, getting enough face masks and other personal protective equipment early on was tough." Dr. Jennifer Bacani-McKinney added, "The community is tired, frustrated, and stubborn. Politicians talk about relying on personal responsibility to end the coronavirus pandemic, but I don't see a majority of people wearing face masks in public spaces, despite pleas from health professionals. Some people are scared. Other people act as if COVID-19 doesn't exist." She added, "Politics is making things harder. I have been Wilson County's health officer for the past 8 years. This year, county commissioners gained more control over COVID-19 health decisions." She added, "When I proposed a face mask mandate early on in the pandemic, one county commissioner argued it would violate his rights. Another commissioner balked at one of my reports saying I had no right to tell schools how to evacuate kids before they can return to sports, despite the health risks, adding, I recently proposed a new face mask mandate given our rising numbers. I explained that masks could not only save lives, they would help businesses stay open and keep employees at work. The commissioners voted it down 3-0. Dr. Bakani McKenney added, we live in an interconnected world where commerce and people cross state and national borders, and with that comes the risk of new diseases. America will face another pandemic in the future for sure. Rural healthcare delivery systems can leverage lessons from COVID-19 to prepare. Among other things, their emergency preparedness tabletop exercises can include planning for infectious disease outbreaks, in addition to fire and floods, mass casualty incidents, and chemical spills. They can permanently diversify supply chain options from other industries, such as construction industry and agriculture industry, to help ensure access to needed supplies. To avoid staff and supply shortages, they can create regional rural healthcare networks for swapping staff, conducting testing, and acquiring supplies. Meanwhile, doctors in rural America and healthcare administrators are being as flexible as possible and resourceful as they can in the face of adversity.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Alternative to Complaining. Brothers and sisters, don't waste your time complaining. Use your energy to create a solution. If you're not lighting any candles, don't complain about the dark. Sometimes we see people, they're complaining, this is broken, this is wrong, the world is a disaster, the world is like this. But when you look at themselves, they're not really doing anything to solve this problem or the list of problems that they may have. So if you're not lighting a candle of your own, you should not be complaining about the darkness. Complaining is a complete waste of one's energy. Those who complain the most accomplish the least. This is a rule of thumb. You see that, you look at successful people, you would find that there are people who are content. They're not complaining, they're not whining, they're not just, losing hope, and hence they become successful. But there are others who complain and they waste their time and energy in complaining rather than finding the solution, right? Those who complain the most, they accomplish the least. And as you waste your breath complaining about life, someone out there is breathing their last. Always keep that in mind. Appreciate what you have. Be thankful and stop complaining. Live more, complain less. Have more smiles and less stress. Stop talking about your problems and start thinking about solutions. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about the alternative to complaining. And we said that there are some people who are busy complaining, whining, and they attain, if not nothing, then the least. But those who focus on finding the solutions, they attain and accomplish a lot in this lifetime. Psychology says that when you focus on your problems, you will have more problems. When you focus on possibilities, you will have more opportunities. Repetitive complaining will attract things for you to complain about. Repeated gratitude will attract things for you to be thankful about. Don't let someone dim your light simply because it's shining in their eyes. You see, it really depends on the type of company you keep and the type of role models you have in your life. If you have a company of hopeless people, you know, people who live their lives in despair, and every time you sit down and hang out with them, they just say something like, you know, oh, nothing is fixable, you know, nothing can be amended, this world is a mess, you know, everything in my life is a mess, everything in your life is a mess. These types of people, they pull you into this whole cloud of or environment of, you know, hopelessness and despair. So know that you have to stay focused. You have to embrace challenges. You have to know that if there is a challenge in the world, then there is a solution for that challenge. You are the one who can find that solution. You need to be around people who are optimistic and who are ready to face the challenges of life. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New figures from the UN and the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute show that since the war in Yemen began, the US has sold over $13 billion in high-tech weapons to Saudi Arabia, making the kingdom a cash cow for US weapons makers. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading Shocking new figures show how just much the U.S. is fueling the violence in Yemen. Here's the details of this article. Despite presenting itself as a force for good and peace in the West Asia region, the United States sells at least five times as much weaponry to Saudi Arabia than aid it donates to Yemen. the State Department constantly portrays itself as a humanitarian superpower with the welfare of the Yemeni people as its highest priority. Yet figures released from the United Nations and the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, show that since the war in Yemen began, the U.S. government has given $2.56 billion in aid to the country, but sold over $13 billion in high-tech weapons to the Saudi Arabian regime, the leader of the coalition prosecuting a relentless onslaught against Yemen. Figures like these are always debatable. What constitutes legitimate aid is a question everyone would answer differently. Furthermore, the $13 billion figure does not include the enormous weapon deal Saudi Arabia signed with Donald Trump in 2017, which will reportedly see the kingdom purchase $350 billion over 10 years. SIPRI is skeptical of the size of these numbers, but if they prove to be correct, once the orders begin arriving, they will make the poultry aid donations seem like small change by comparison. Sales include all manner of military equipment, from radar and transport systems to F-15 fighter jets, TOW missiles, Abrams tanks, and Paladin howitzers. While the Saudi pay in petrodollars, Yemenis pay in blood. 4 years ago, the Saudi Air Force bombed a well-attended funeral in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. It was a bright, clear day. The Saudis used a double-tap airstrike to ensure maximum carnage. 240 people were killed, and like with 2018 Saudi attack on a school bus that killed 40 children, the bombs that did the damage were 500-pound, about 227-kilogram MK-82s built and supplied by Lockheed Martin, America's largest weapons contractor. Making billions from arms exports, which fueled the conflict, while providing a small fraction of that in aid to Yemen, is both immoral and incoherent. The world's wealthiest nations cannot continue to put profits above the Yemeni people, said Mohsin Siddiqui, Oxfam Yemen country director. Already the region's poorest nation, Yemen, has been utterly devastated by the six-year conflict. The United Nations estimates that 14 million people, over half of the country's population, are at risk of famine, and 20.5 million need help accessing drinkable water. 80% of the population, it calculates, needs some form of humanitarian assistance. The Saudi-led coalition, which includes the UAE, Qatar, and Bahrain, has deliberately attacked soft targets like hospitals and water facilities, carrying out the equivalent of one strike against such buildings every 10 days since the fighting began. The fact that the United Nations faced with such enormous human, environmental, and migration devastation around the world has said for several years now that Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. That says it all. This war has devastated what was already the poorest country in the Arab world. Not only the direct bombing of funerals or weddings, but the blockading and bombing of the ports. Yemen is a country very dependent on imported food, basic medicines, and everything. So when the ports are closed down, people move close to starvation very quickly. Phyllis Ben is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and an expert on the West Asia region, told Mint Press. In addition to supplying the weapons, the United States regime and many of its European allies trained Saudi forces, have provided critical military infrastructure and logistical support, and even refueled Saudi bombers in the air and provided targeting guidance to help Saudi forces find their marks more efficiently. On top of that, the U.S. has shielded Riyadh from international censure by defending it at bodies like the United Nations. In essence, the U.S. is involved in every area of the Yemen conflict, doing everything up to pulling the trigger itself. The U.S. must end its support for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and instead prioritize the people across Yemen fighting to survive, Scott Paul, Oxfam America's humanitarian policy lead, told Mint Press in a statement recently. The U.S. has passed much of its aid to the most vulnerable Yemenis, while it continues to provide weapons that fuel the deadly conflict. Congress and the American people have made it clear that they do not want any part in this. We continue to call for the United States, the international community, and all parties to the conflict to push for peace, and we will hold the incoming administration to its pledge to do its part. The United States has a long history of mistreating Yemen. In 1990, the administration of George W. Bush wanted a unanimous United Nations agreement to rubber stamp its attack on Iraq. Yemen, newly appointed to the Security Council, refused to go along with the resolution, as did Cuba. Just minutes after it voted against the U.S. plan, a senior American diplomat told the Yemeni representative on a hot mic, "That was the most expensive no vote you ever cast." Within hours, all U.S. aid, that is about $70 million program, to the country was stopped. 800,000 Yemeni workers were expelled from Saudi Arabia, and the country had difficulties securing loans with international financial institutions. Thus, as Benny said, the U.S. refusal to take Yemen and Yemenis seriously goes back a very long way. Saudi Arabia has proven to be one of the United States' most loyal allies in the region over the past 50 years, and its enforcer. In return for keeping the oil money flowing into the United States, Washington has been willing to defend the country's abysmal human rights record, and even to overlook the assassination of journalists like the Washington Post's Jamal Khashoggi. Andrew Feinstein, an arms industry expert and author of Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, explained to Mint Press that the U.S. has allied itself with Saudi Arabia despite it being one of the world's most corrupt countries and worst human rights abusers, at home and abroad, for two primary reasons: oil and the U.S. right desire for regime change in independent countries. This is despite the reality that Saudi is the primary ideological supporter and financier and weaponizer of the most extreme groups. Under Trump, the United States has sharply increased its military support to Saudi Arabia, signing a number of weapons deals that put the lie to any idea that he was an anti-war president. Overall, SIPRI calculates that the United States accounted for 36% of global weapons sales between 2015 and 2019, a large increase over the previous 5 years. Saudi Arabia is by far America's best customer, and America is the kingdom's most important supplier, accounting for 3/4 of all purchases. In 2019, this included 59,000 guided bombs, most of which were destined to be dropped on soft targets in Yemen. As Benis noted, the Saudis buy more arms from the U.S. than any other country in the world, so it is embedded in the very fabric of the military-industrial complex here. Furthermore, many of Washington's other best customers are also West Asian dictatorships also bombing Yemen. Saudi Arabia will be hosting the G20 summit, a meeting of the 20 most powerful nations in the world. And while the G20 is being urged to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for its role in Yemen, that possibility seems doubtful, seeing as G20 arms exports to Riyadh are 3 times what they give to Yemen in aid. This was the view echoed by Yemenis on the ground who spoke to Min Press. Ibrahim Abdul Karim, who lost his infant child when a Saudi warplane dropped a U.S.-made bomb on his home in Sana'a in 2015, said that Biden's statement of intention on foreign affairs was not good enough. The big question here is the new U.S. president will actually stop the massive arms sales of basics, the F-15s, the F-16s, the bombers and bombs, the drones, the ammunition and equipment that is responsible for so much death and destruction in Yemen? Is he prepared to do that? I'm hopeful, but not terribly optimistic. This is the view echoed by Yemenis on the ground who spoke to Min Press. Ibrahim Abdul Karim, who lost his infant child when a Saudi warplane dropped a U.S.-made bomb on his home in Sana'a in 2015, said that Biden's statement of intention on foreign affairs was not good enough. I'm not optimistic that Biden will stop supplying Saudi Arabia leader Mohammed bin Salman with bombs like the ones that killed my daughter, he stated. In international affairs, money talks. And the United States is making a lot of it from this war.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries. It indicates that civilization and culture and that modern jahiliyyah, ignorance, is really dark and wild in its nature and in its reality. Of course, they are hiding this savagery. That is because they are equipped with science and technology. They cover their savagery up with science and technology, and they hide it this way. They appear in public by uttering civilized words with a humanistic appearance and by wearing ties and perfume, thus covering up their inner savagery. So, Islam and the Holy Prophet are not harmed this way. But this is a means so that you and I can gain a deeper understanding of that civilization. That civilization is really a wild civilization. It has also created a disastrous situation for its nations.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In the present time, even after the passage of several centuries from the beginning of that civilization during the Renaissance, you can witness inequality, poverty, injustice, and moral decadence in European countries, in the US, and in those countries which follow them. This is the nature of that civilization and culture. This was about the first issue. As for Unity Week, today, more than ever, the importance of Imam's initiative has become clear. The day when our magnanimous Imam announced Unity Week, and the day when he announced the unity of Islamic denominations in their general, political, and social orientations, many real addressees of the message could not understand its significance. Many officials in Islamic countries did not understand how important the message was. Many did not understand it, and many defied it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.